The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujak, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
As our country's population ages, the number of people with dementia continues to rise. On previous editions of UWM Today, we've talked about some of the many challenges facing those who suffer from dementia and those who care for people with a condition. On today's program, we consider a new aspect of helping those with dementia and Alzheimer's, and it involves something as simple as lowering the decibel level in the rooms where those patients live. Joining us on today's program is Laura Josie, who is an assistant professor of nursing at UWM's College of Nursing. Welcome, Laura. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
And you did some, I think, fascinating research because you looked at something that should be so apparent to anyone who walks into a nursing home, and that is sound levels.
Yes.
Tell us what you found.
Sure. Well, I became interested in this because I recognized patterns in my patients that identified an issue for me that I think we really overlooked, and that was how sound or noise can stimulate individuals who suffer from dementia. And I did a small pilot study in a hospital trying to identify, okay, what are the variables behind this and recognize this pattern. I then took it to a little bit larger study and examined 53 residents who lived in four different nursing homes. I examined them on eight different nursing units and demonstrated really the hypothesis that I had that sound could contribute to levels of agitation in people who suffer from dementia.
Now, what kind of sound are we talking about? Is it is it a loud TV or people yelling down the hallway or some of the more normal everyday sounds that we might have?
That's a great question. And I call the sounds non-therapeutic sounds. And so I examined sound levels. And I categorized these sound levels into different sources. And so looking at exactly what you just said, is it loud music, loud television, or is it people yelling across the room?
And which of these was more common and more troublesome?
Well, interesting. I thought that it would be physical sounds. And so operational sounds of the organization, so heating and cooling sorts of things. But the majority of the sounds were from humans creating the sounds. And so it can be either talking or from them doing something that creates a sound.
So with this noise, we'll call it noise, that is occurring in a nursing home, I mean, you're going to have some sort of sound, people taking care of other people and the like. Were there instances where you saw that there was an extreme that could be addressed more easily than other sounds or noises?
Definitely. After my last study where I looked at the relationship between sound and agitation and found that there was a significant correlation, I went back to my data and also went back to the literature to see, okay, well, what are these sounds? And can we pattern any or can we identify any patterns in sounds and identify areas that we can focus on? And the first thing I did was, okay, well, when do these sounds occur? And I looked at the data that I had collected over the course of the day and identified that mealtime was one of the louder times of the day in these nursing homes. And so it consists of three times a day when individuals have their meals, and it's a significant part of their day. And so that is where I decided to start targeting. Then I went back and looked at, well, what are the sounds that are created during those times, and can we do anything about it?
And what did you find?
Well, I developed a sound abatement protocol. So really a framework for identifying the sounds, then making recommendations of how we can reduce or change those sounds in the organizations. Now, each facility is different. So I created this template just as a generic template. But because each organization is a little bit different, I needed to do an environmental assessment for each organization that I work with. And so I take that template and then augment it with tailored specific sound reduction strategies for their organization.
What was the biggest problem that you found in these nursing homes? What sound was to you at the end of your research the easiest one to correct?
Great question. Music and television. Most people, when I say a level of decibels, they won't understand really what that number means, but I'll give you sort of some context behind it. Anything over 60 decibels interferes with our ability to communicate with each other. So if we're at a concert, we usually can't talk to each other. We can sort of see each other's mouths moving and guess what we're trying to say. But the sound level prevents us from being able to communicate with each other. And what I found in some nursing homes were that they were providing this wonderful music or a television program, but the sound levels were so high that it was interfering with people to be able to communicate with each other.
And what does that do to the patient? What does that do to that person with dementia who is in the middle of this din?
Well, what we believe is that they have a difficult time understanding their environment. And so if we couple that with these loud sounds, our hypothesis is that it only adds to their confusion.
So they start out confused, and when you mix in a lot of noise, it makes it more difficult for them to clear through the confusion?
Yes.
What about those, and I've been in nursing homes with visiting relatives and the like over the years, and without singling out, well, I guess I will single out one sound, Lawrence Welk. It seems every time I went to visit relatives, Lawrence Welk is cranked up, if it's especially on a Saturday night. And when we said something, they said, well, you know, they're older. They can't hear as well. And so we really got to crank the music up so that they can hear. So is that necessarily true?
You bring up an interesting point. Unfortunately, that's a stereotype that all older people are hard of hearing, which is not necessarily true. In fact, in my study, I found that only 25% of the residents in my study had difficulty with hearing. And so that's a lower percentage. But there is this stereotype that, well, older people are hard of hearing. And so we need to crank up that music or that television program so that they can all hear. And one of the things that I do with these organizations is identify that problem and then help them figure out ways in which the people who are hard of hearing can enjoy that music, but yet it's not annoying to those who have good hearing.
Yeah. Now, did you focus primarily on patients with dementia, or were others without that condition mixed into the study?
Correct. Well, the first study that I did examining sound levels and agitation only included individuals who were moderate to severe levels of dementia. The sound abatement study, which was the next study, I didn't identify particular individuals. I was just looking at the environment where they live. And so the sound abatement protocol study was done on two dementia units.
And when you went ahead and brought to the attention this issue with the folks in the nursing homes, what sort of reaction did you get? Were they aware that this might even conceivably have been a problem?
Sure. Well, I selected two nursing homes who believed that they had a problem with sound and would like to address it. And they believed that they had a problem with sound because either they recognized it themselves, family members of the residents recognized it, or in one organization, the resident council had talked about it, that it was very loud during mealtime.
So that's where you came in, by actually coming in and trying to document exactly what those conditions were.
Right.
Was there any one room where the sound issues were greater, general gathering spaces versus an individual patient's room, for example?
Well, I targeted communal dining spaces. So that is an area where individuals come together and eat their meals together. And so in this particular study, we had a maximum room that would accommodate 54 residents. And okay. So a fairly large size room.
So what kind of noises did you hear in that dining room that were problematic?
Great. Well, beyond the music or the television, we create sounds by the process of the work that we do. And so I would tell the staff that, you know, no one gets up in the morning and says, I think I'm going to go to work and create as much sound as I possibly can. They just don't do that. These are great people who are trying to do wonderful things for the residents that live in these environments. Unfortunately, to be efficient, to provide meals to about 50 residents, you have to do things in a more efficient way sometimes. And that, in and of itself, creates a lot of sound. And so one of the examples were a trend was that they would set up, prepare for the meal when the residents were in the room. And so that was added clinging and clanging that the residents were exposed to. And I call that sound level a dose. So as we try to look at reducing the sound levels, I would refer to it as the dose of sound. So how much an individual is exposed to that sound. The other area was the cleaning up of a meal. So after the meal is done, then the staff would remove the dishes and they would scrape them perhaps right at the side of the resident. And so, again, that's that clanging and noise created from cleaning up a meal.
When you've got a patient who's or a resident who is sitting in the midst of that clinging and the clanging and what have you, your research suggests that added noise is actually increasing the amount of anxiety.
Yes.
But I also saw in reading your work that not only does it increase anxiety, but it removes the ease with which these people can communicate.
Correct.
I found that really interesting.
It's twofold. In the nursing home environments, we're really aiming to have their mealtime be a social environment for them. So they come together and they eat meals together, and it's really intended to be social for these individuals who are living there. The sound prevents them from, at times, being able to be social, particularly when the sound is over 60 decibels. My previous research demonstrated that not only can it interfere with the social components of that mealtime, but also adds to that level of stimulation that can contribute to agitation in these folks.
You know, as you describe that environment, I have to confess, I think of myself sitting in some restaurants, and there are a couple in particular that come to my mind where when my wife and I go there, we love the food, but we just know it's tough to talk. I mean, one place has sort of an old tin ceiling, and it truly is a din, and I've walked out wondering, why didn't I learn how to read lips? I could have used that tonight. And I know the sense of frustration that I get. It must be multiplied many times by patients with dementia who themselves are struggling on so many other different fronts.
We think so. And that's why we were interested in doing this type of research and in helping improve these environments. Because like you said, if you and I were to go out to a restaurant and have this conversation, we would like an ambient environment that would support us to be able to communicate. Unfortunately, some of these organizations had sound levels unknowingly that weren't supportive of a social environment for them.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack. Joining us in the studio is Laura Josie, who's the assistant professor of nursing at UWM's College of Nursing, involved in this fascinating research work looking at the way in which noise can have an impact on people who live in nursing homes. Laura, as we think about the people that we love and visit or will be visiting in the future who are in nursing homes, what sort of advice would you give to us in terms of how we either address that noise issue individually or maybe talk to the people who are running the nursing homes? Is it something that we ought to bring to the attention of the folks in these places?
That's a great question. And in fact, I have an example of a resident's family member who gave me a story from his wife. She had been admitted to a nursing home. And when he had heard that I was studying sound in their particular nursing home, he said that it was a really good idea because his wife had been admitted to this nursing home. She had been there for about 2 days, and the staff had called him and said that she was missing. Well, the staff then did a facility-wide search, and they found her hiding in a closet. And when the husband came and approached her and talked to her about this, she said, "It's just too loud here." So she was trying to find a quiet space for herself, and he thought this was a great research project that we could really inform and start having the conversations about the sound environment and how we can change it.
Can it be too quiet in a nursing home? I mean, you think there are certainly, as you point out, some big negatives of having this chaos and this din that is around you. But could you go to the other extreme also?
Yes, you can. And actually, there is some research that suggests that understimulation can also cause increased levels of confusion. And we see that particularly in patients who are hospitalized and are in isolation. They will develop what we call delirium, which is a short-term acute change in mentation for them. And so we have to be careful, and we need to try to balance that level of stimulation. What I suggest to the organizations and really to their family members, because I've talked to quite a few of them as well, that they know their loved one and they know what patterns they lived by. And so for me, I like it nice and quiet. My husband has the radio on in every single room, and it drives me crazy sometimes. I need to walk around and turn them off. So our family knows those things about us and can share those with nursing home staff if, you know, we were ever to need nursing home placement. And so not only do you know your loved one and you can share that information about it, but you recognize patterns. And many of the family members that I've talked to recognize the pattern that it was just too loud for their loved one in that dining room.
So even with dementia, although they've lost, folks with that condition have lost some of their capacity to function cognitively as they had in the past, there still are those deep embedded traits that are still part of them, even though they may not be able to think as clearly as they could before.
Absolutely. And we hear that from the family members. And we really focus on person-centered care in nursing homes, and we identify or we try to get as much information about that resident as we possibly can to help create an environment that's most like what they were used to.
What about the music hours, the social activities that take place in many nursing homes to provide that stimulation that you suggested is so important? Should we be concerned about the noise level during those episodes of entertainment or generated excitement?
Great question. What I explain to the staff and try to train them on is to identify patterns of behavior in each individual. And so if they're recognizing that when a resident goes to this activity therapy and they become agitated during that therapy, we need to consider whether that sound was a contributing factor. It may not be for the majority of them, but once we start to see these behaviors, we need to question what is the cause of that behavior.
So it really is important that each patient, each resident, be treated differently. It shouldn't be a cattle call that necessarily rounds everybody up out of the rooms and brings them into an environment that might be disturbing to some.
Absolutely. And I focused on the mealtime because it was a social environment or a time of the day that would promote some socialization for these residents and trying to aim at helping that environment be conducive for that. Activity therapy is a little bit different because it's a purposeful way to provide someone with some enjoyment of such. Music is one of those ways in which we provide activities for the individuals. But again, during those times, we need to look at the residents and see how they're reacting to that sound.
And it could change day to day with people with dementia, right?
It certainly could. It's also, I'd like to bring up not just the sound level, but perhaps the type of music that might be provided. And so we each know that we have different likes and dislikes. And so I like country. My oldest son dislikes country. And so if you put us both in the same room and play country, I'll love it. he'll dislike it. And so we need to think about those things as well when we're providing activities for our patients and residents.
You know, it's going to get real interesting when folks our generation end up in a nursing home, because I'm not sure Lawrence Welk will cut it anymore. Neil Young, maybe,
yes.
You know, a little Led Zeppelin. But
yes.
But imagine the great range of music in the rock genre. There may be a real interesting time 30 or 40 years from now in these nursing homes, right?
Right. And again, we're looking at more individualized care for people. And I think baby boomers are going to demand it.
They'll have their earbuds. Everybody will be wired into their iPod at that time.
Sure.
In addition to the work that you're doing, looking at noise in the nursing home in terms of how it impacts the individual residents, I understand that you're also doing research that takes a look at other communication that occurs between the staff themselves.
Yes. Well, we recognize that patients have a story, and they have an enormous amount of data that comes around that story. And I'm working with some folks at Aurora who are interested in telling that story across venues. And so we have submitted a proposal looking at a longitudinal coordinated plan of care, which will really aim to tell the patient's story across venues of care. Because we can design great interventions, but unless we know our individual patients really well and identify what will work for them and not work for them and share that across venues of care, we're, again, then starting over each time we see a brand new person.
Well, how does that differ from all the medical records that follow us around from clinic to hospital to a place like a nursing home?
That's a great question, because I think every one of your listeners probably has been exposed to an electronic medical record of some sort, either when they go see their physician in the primary care office or when they're hospitalized. That electronic environment does collect, or we enter data into that environment that collects your information. But we also recognize that it might not be sharing a complete story. And so I'll give you an example. We'll share the information like a patient has moderate stages of dementia. And so, well, what does that mean? There are many different layers and many different symptoms that are associated with dementia. And so we don't get down to the granular level of what that is at this time. And that's something that this project is aiming to focus on.
It sounds almost like you're talking about creating a narrative that provides more context for what the test results showed or what was observed during some sort of experiment or experience in terms of a treatment room.
Exactly. It's really an attempt to share the patient's story across venue. And I think many of your listeners might be able to identify this. You see one caregiver, and then you go see another caregiver, and you need to share with them the same information. And you might say, gosh, I just told the person that I saw yesterday the same information. And so we're aiming to try to develop a system that will allow us to be able to share that information across venue.
So when you do that, is it going to require the providers, the physicians, the nurses to go ahead and ask better questions or find a way to record those responses in a fuller fashion than you currently do?
It's really twofold. It's what information do we need to collect and how do we need to transfer it to the next level of care?
So does that mean using technology? Is that one of the tools that would help make this line of information or the stream of information more helpful to providers in different settings?
Yes. The electronic environment is the method of delivery, but what we load into that is very important.
So are you talking about like a software program that would prompt the right questions, or is it indeed a way to capture a physician or a nurse speaking into a recording device and saying, here's what I found?
Right. Well, most of the environments that we're looking at now are humans have to actually enter the data into the electronic environment. But what data we enter is the important question. And that's the question that we're aiming to focus on. So what information is important from the receiver and the sender.
Yeah. So getting back to the nursing home setting, what difference could that make, that chain of command in terms of sharing information, what difference could that make for people in a residential care setting where they're unlikely to leave, where they may be for a long time?
Right. Well, we are very interested in information sharing across venues. And so I'll give you an example. So I'll give you a personal example. My mother fell and fractured her hip and her shoulder, and she was admitted to a hospital, and they pinned her hip and just immobilized her shoulder. Then she was transferred from a hospital to a nursing home where she will need skilled nursing care for quite some time. The limited information that was shared during that transfer to me was scary. It didn't give the nurses in the nursing home enough information to plan, predict, and organize her care. So that's just one example. There are numerous examples of where we lack the ability to be able to tell all the important details about the patient and their story.
You know, it sounds like this could be very helpful, not just for the resident or the patient themselves, but also for the families. Because as you point out with your mother, and I had the same situation with my mother, where you find yourself accompanying them into a physician's office or into a therapy session, I often felt that I wasn't fully prepared to answer questions that, and I was sort of on the spot, like, we need to know right now. And I wish I had been given some time to study for that quiz.
Yes. Well, hopefully an environment which we can, you know, possibly create could fill that gap.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it sounds like a fascinating direction that your research is taking. And any timeline when you're likely to get some results?
Well, as many people recognize, we have budgetary constraints, and so funding is always the issue of when studies are funded and what pilot work we need to do. And so it's to be determined at this point.
Yeah, yeah. And it sounds like one of those great, great examples of research that can really have a profound impact once you do get answers to these key questions. Well, listen, we wish you the very best. We'll hope that funding does appear so that you can move forward with that research project. And we congratulate you for the work that you've done working on noise in those nursing home settings. Some wonderful, wonderful insights and probably some good information for each one of us to keep in mind should we ever be in that environment where we're with a loved one who needs someone looking out for them, providing that extra bit of advice or insight to the caregivers.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Laura Josie, Assistant Professor of Nursing, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. As usual, we thank you for taking some time out of your week to learn about the amazing array of faculty and researchers doing great things at the UWM campus. Well, that's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everyone. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet the faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.